This morning we are again on the subject, the spirit of the law overrides the letter of the law. It's so important that we understand this truth. I'm going to tell you something that I haven't told you all the time I've been ministering here, although I've known it all the time. I don't want you to think it's pride, because it's not. If it were, it would have come out a long time ago. But more and more I'm being felt led to share my heart with you on a personal basis, because you hear me preach as the Lord anoints me, but you don't hear me think. And a lot of times those wrong motives, well, you do a bit, it sneaks out here and there, you know, throughout, but a lot of times people don't understand, they misunderstand and don't get to know you from that standpoint. And I just feel more and more to let people know what the cogs that are turning inside, what's happening. And I hope there isn't misunderstanding of it. A lot of people, what they do is they take how they would feel and then they assign it to somebody else. And you got to be careful that you don't project your mind into somebody else's body, because he doesn't have your mind. And some people take their motives, and if they have pride, they take it and they automatically push their pride in somebody else. He says, and he says, oh, he must be full of pride, because they would be full of pride, see? But you've got to learn. One thing we have to learn to understand one another is you have to listen to the individual. And you have to hear what he's saying. And his standpoint. He doesn't think like you do. It's so easy to project your thinking into somebody else. I've been watching this happening. And just so many people. He says a certain thing. They take their thinking and project it into his mind. And the whole thing is turned around and means something different, because they projected themselves instead of listening and saying, well, they're different. They think different. And this is what they are. And I'm going to have to understand it from their side. They try to understand it from where they are, and they never understand it. It's like the Americans trying to understand the Chinese and say, well, if we be good to them, and we show integrity and we abide by our agreement, then they'll abide by theirs. But that's Christian thinking, and they're communists. They know nothing about such things. And the people over there who know those people, they say, that isn't how those people think at all. We do a kindness, so we expect a kindness in return. To them, when you do a kindness, it means you're weak. They know nothing about mercy and love. And I'm saying they're weakening. And they're weak. And you have to understand how people think and what they are. And one thing, I'm a little bit warm. How many are too warm in here, like me? Let's put some fans on or whatever. One thing that I've been cognizant of a long time that God has done for me, that is really quite unique, and I know that it's not me. I don't give myself any credit, because I can't help it what he did for me. You know, a person didn't have to have false humility. When you go in for a job, you say, well, you know, I can type so many words a minute, and I can do this, and I can do this, and I can do this. That doesn't mean you're bragging. That doesn't mean you're bragging. You need to qualify your position. There's no sense going in saying, well, I probably just kind of a poor typist. I can't keep, you know, I'm probably not too good at this thing, and so forth. You never get a job that way. I mean, it's even dishonest. If you're going to be honest, you know, see, there's a place, let's put it this way, there's a place of pride, see, where you feel, because you can do something, that you're so great. And then there's a place of humility, in which you know that you can do things, and you'll say them where you need to, for their own understanding, admonition, learning, and for the benefit of the company and yourself and others. But you do it recognizing that you know it. But because you know that you know it, and you may know you're the best one in the whole planet in this, and you may be, and you may know it. You may know that you are the expert in this field, and nobody can do it like you. It may be very manifest. You may be able to, the fruits of it are right out in front of you. And the knowledge of it is not pride. And as a matter of fact, telling people about it is not pride. Pride is that feeling, it's a feeling inside that in some people are there because they know it. Now, some people can know it with all humility. They know it. It's true. But they don't feel puffed up about it. It's pretty false to have to think you can't do something that you know you can. As if you say, I want somebody who's expert at hand for me. Come on, we'll get this thing straightened out. And if nobody will step forward, because everybody's supposed to think that they can't do it, you never can get something done. And in the church of God, if you don't know that you can, that your field is music ministry, and you can teach people because you know more than they do about it, you can never have confidence to take the job and never do anything. It's completely false that you cannot say what you can do for fear that maybe that's pride. That's not pride. And a person has to be pretty blind not to know when God gives him a gift, when he can do things. But he should never think himself great because of a gift given him. Somebody comes and hands you a package, and now you've got something. That doesn't make you wonderful. He gave it to you. If you didn't have it before, it isn't of your own making. And no man can self-make himself into anything grand and glorious. And every talent you've got is given of God. It's a gift. So no person has any right, in my estimation, to ever think of himself great and grand and glorious. I know a lot of people who have thought that. I have thought this about myself, and they completely misunderstand me. God had done that work in my heart a long time ago. I understand completely. I know what I am, and that's nothing. I'm nothing. And then anything that I have is a gift given by God. And I got no right to credit. I don't feel any credit. I don't feel great and the rest of this thing. People have been projecting their mind into me. And I guess God has done that work. God has probably done that work in me. The reason I'm not proud in these areas is probably not because I'm so great that I'm humble. It's because God, in order to be able to use me so I won't ruin myself and ruin you, has had to do that thing. That may be a gift. I don't know. But I am cognizant that God has done something. And I'm quite sure that the reason he's done it is because of the type of ministry that's healed. God has called me to bring lots and lots of, there's lots of brand new babies. And people come in from all kinds of thinking and all kinds of confusion in different areas. And all of a sudden, you've got to try to do something with them. When a lot of people, the average person and the average teacher, he thinks, if I can relate this, way uphill, kind of in this area. But he comes up now, he's got a sharp mind, he's got a keen mind, he's an A student type, and he's got a lot of critical acumen, he can think good, and he studied languages and so forth, and he gets together and he gets all the data. He's got all the tools, he's got the books, he knows how to study, he knows how to put them together, and he's putting together this information. And he's doing the Greek word studies, and he's lining them all up, and he's categorizing them, and he knows how to correlate and all the rest. And he comes up with what he calls a real scholarly piece of work. And it may be very good. But if that's all you can do, you're laboring under a great handicap. And that's all that most can do. It really is. So for years and years, I mean, how long they teach. Everything, I'll look it up, line it up, and then I'll see what I can find out. But there's something a lot deeper than that. And I've been cognizant for a long time that the Lord, and so appreciate the Lord has done this, and I don't deserve it. I don't know why he picked on me to do it. But I know this. I know that God has done something in me that has taken way down here and at a grassroots level. He has given me the understanding of why things are like they are. What are the principles in which things are built? What is the basic principles that you build blocks on? How, the time you get this, how does it relate to everything downhill? And I know that it's this basic, it's just not adding facts and information. There's so many people who keep, and they want to go on and say, well, what about this? And they're hunting for a lot of data uphill. That's all they can do. But God has done something, infused something. I'm very cognizant. I'm very, very cognizant. In fact, I've been just standing in amazement of it so many times as I've seen people with a lot more experience than I have, older than I am, with a lot more. They've been around, been in the ministry longer and so forth. And I'm amazed because I see they don't have this. They don't understand these things down here. They're still operating up here. I can see their mind working. I can see that they don't know, and they want to add some more things and look into it. They never seem to be able to apply all these things and know where things are at as a very basic. And I think maybe because they've got a congregation that's already in fair shape intellectually. But I guess because if you're going to get a people like this from so many walks of life and thinking them brand new and hold them in this day and age, there's got to be something down here where you can show them the basis of things and get it all straightened out and hold them. Otherwise, there's no chance of getting the people from here to there. And I guess that's the only reason God's done it. So I'm very cognizant of that, very appreciative. I've never said that all these years. I stood in amazement as I've seen what God has enabled me to see and do, and I know it's not myself. I know it isn't. I can see that there's no chance that how could I have arrived at that at this point when other people haven't at that point? And there's something now, maybe others can't see it because, you know, a person without wisdom doesn't really know it. There are people, you know, who are quite ignorant and very low intellect. And oftentimes, their thinking is always, you know, they think this and this and this. And the person who's wise, a lot of wisdom, been around, he looks down and says, oh my, that's poor thinking. But he doesn't know it's poor thinking. He's quite proud of it. That's the best he can come up with. And your thinking is always, whatever you think is right, you see. And it takes a wiser one, usually, to look down and look at the younger children, for example, and say, well, that's not very wise. But he thinks it's wise. That's why he's doing it. That's why he's falling in the ditch, too. He thinks it's wise. The little children think he's wise. Well, I think, see, he's 9 years old, but I think, you look, and the parent looks at him and, you know, smiles and says, you know, that's really immature thinking. But he doesn't know it. It's up to date, the highest, best thing he's ever had. See. Well, that's one reason, this is a prelude to my message this morning, that's one reason God has given. If God calls somebody and he gives them a certain ability in, say, praying for the sick, people should rely on the one that God has given them. After all, God's given them something that you don't have. And if God's given somebody wisdom and understanding, then for people to sit out here and they're all going to do their own job, there's a whole bunch of 8-year-olds that are going to all do the job trying to outwit the father who's got some wisdom, say, in a certain area. And it's not self-magnification and big braggadocio of the father when he tells the little one, listen, son, let me tell you something. I love you. You're going to hurt yourself if you don't listen to daddy. Daddy's bragging. No, daddy's not bragging. Daddy's helping. Daddy's being honest. You see, there's a place above where you finally come to a place where you can say what you are, evaluate yourself, say what your abilities are and inabilities with a complete neutral feeling. That's above, see? That's the place you've got to get to if we're ever going to get rid of pride, because if pride's going to be a factor in your life and you can't ever say anything because of pride. If you say anything, if you say your abilities and feel pride, then you're at a place, you're still at a lower place than what you should be. Somewhere we've got to get to where we can be uphill. And a lot of people who still got a lot of pride and can't think too straight in these lines, they accuse the Apostle Paul of having a lot of pride because of the things he said. And he made a lot of statements. But the statements he made were to help. They were necessary statements. They were not the result of pride whatsoever. In fact, the Holy Spirit led him to say them, even about himself. Because they needed to know that. Because if they didn't know that he was way above them and God was giving the revelations and then he is called of God and not what one whit behind the chief, then they can't have trust and confidence in him. And since God called them to have trust and confidence, they're going to have to know what he is. And since they don't know, he's going to have to tell them. Just like the parent has to tell them. And it's nothing to do with pride. So anyway, I don't know how many misunderstand that, but for what's worth, there it is. Now there's a spirit, I'm saying that to say this because to my mind, as the Lord has been dealing with my heart about this matter, I'm bringing up in the morning message, it's so necessary that we understand this, because if we don't have confidence in the one that God has given to lead, then when we reject with our mind and skeptical of what God is bringing forth, we are skeptical of God. We're skeptical of God's doctrine, we're skeptical of God's truth, we're skeptical of God's revelation, we will not believe what God is giving us. And all the skepticism in our own minds, our own wisdom says, well, this is me, I'm being very clever at this. The whole truth is, we're being very stupid because it's God and we're rejecting a revelation that God is giving, and we're going to think with human minds instead of with divine minds and not have the mind of Christ. It's so important we understand it, and since nobody else is telling you, I've got to tell you, unless you're going to get hurt, you're going to get hurt bad. And I hope people can understand that. But I know many people squeeze up, perhaps, when you say it. Now, the spirit of the law is so important. The whole thing comes down to the spirit of the law. But there's so many people trying to outthink me with the letter of the law. They want to override the spirit by the letter. And brother, they're going through here with all those scholarships trying to show this verse. And brother, I got that verse over here and so forth. Listen, brother, I can see a lot deeper than that verse and that verse. Those verses tie in, but they're applied somewhere. There's a light that comes on them. God is showing something. Now, I'm running out of time, so I better hurry up. I wanted to get to my bombshell, but I wanted to take you through another mental gymnastics before we get there. Something to show you something. So I think we'll start over here, and I hope I have time to do both. Let's turn to the book of Matthew, chapter 20. When I started out my class in solving contemporary problems, and I meant solving them in our own minds and hearts, not solving them out in the world, I'm still too warm. I'm going to have a little door cracked open or something. Not a whole howling blizzard, but a little bit. You can believe the typhoon that can come through that full door. In the beginning of my contemporary problems class, I posed this scripture. And most of them were new students, and they've been brought up in the world school. Schools of the world, so they used to world, you know, they're thinking of the world. And it made quite an impact on them to put their thinking up alongside of Jesus' thinking and to see that it looked like that Jesus was unfair. I read an article one time put out a National Lutheran magazine, reprinted from a Presbyterian magazine that says I disagree with Jesus. And when I first saw it, it hit me, you know, real hard. I thought, my, what an audacious title. Even though there's a gimmick to it along the way, and he's going to show you he really agrees. It's some little humorous gimmick. I realized that was true, but nonetheless, I thought, what an audacious title. But when I got into it, I found that it wasn't true that it was a gimmick. He really did disagree with Jesus all the way through. Then I was dumbfounded. I wasn't used to this liberal thinking. And so some people in the class found out that they disagreed with Jesus. But then they of course, had to quickly backtrack and say, well, of course, I must be wrong. But somehow their mind and Jesus' mind didn't parallel each other here. You'd be surprised how many areas out here they don't parallel and get a bun up in the world school. It takes a while to get reoriented. And so here in Matthew, starting with verse 1, chapter 20, Jesus said, "For the kingdom of heaven is likened to a man that is a householder which went out early in the morning to hire laborers into his vineyard. And when he agreed with the laborers for a penny a day, and a penny a day is the standard, was the standard day's wages for soldiers and for workers. It's denarius. So let's call it $15 a day. It's some day's wages, or maybe it's $30 a day, or whatever your day's wages are, but they're day's wages. And they're standard day's wages. Let's talk about a 10-hour day, so let's say $20 a day. Maybe it's not high wages, but it's wages. All right, when he agreed with the laborers for $20 a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And when he went out about the third hour and saw others standing idle in the marketplace, because the marketplace where they went to hire people were not in the marketplace, just stood there idle waiting for somebody to come in and hire them. They didn't have any union halls and so forth, and didn't have telephones and newspaper advertisements, and the farmers went down to the marketplace, and you just stood strong, who wants to come work for me? And they'd all choose the laborers and head out to the fields early in the morning. So they're all standing out early in the marketplace waiting to be hired. So early in the morning, he went out and he hired some people. He agreed to pay them the standard day's wages, $20 a day. And he went out about the third hour. Now, the third hour then is 9 o'clock in the morning instead of 6 o'clock, which would be the first hour. And he saw people standing idle, and he said to them, "Go also in the vineyard, and whatsoever's right, I'll give you. I'll pay you whatever's right." And they thought, well, okay, I'll get probably $20 minus a little bit. And he went their way. Again, he went out about the sixth hour, that's at noon, and the ninth hour, which is 3:00 PM, and he did likewise. He saw that the harvest just wasn't going to get done. He just had to have more help. It was getting late, but he just couldn't let the day go on. So he went out and said, "I'll give you whatever's right. Just come in, just quickly." And they all said, "Okay, fine." And they expected him to be fair with them now and give them what's right, whatever's a fair proportion of $20. And about the 11th hour, and so here they were now, as you see, it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon. They quit at 6. We have a 12-hour day, actually. Or maybe I should say $24 a day, 12-hour day. Anyway, they went about the 11th hour, 5 o'clock, he went out, and he found others standing idle. He said to them, "Why stand ye here all the day idle?" They said to him, "Because no man hath hired us." He saith to them, "Go ye also in the vineyard, and whatsoever is right, that you'll receive." Well, it won't get much, but it's a little bit better than nothing. So when evening was come, 6 o'clock, the lord of the vineyard said unto his steward, "Call the laborers, pay them the money, the hire, beginning from the last unto the first." And when they came, they were hired. About the 11th hour, they received every man, would say, $24. But when they came, when the first came, they supposed they should have received more. See, they all lined them all up. And the one who worked 1 hour, he said, "Okay, here's your $24. And one that worked 3 hours, here's 24. And one that worked 6, here's your 24. And one that worked 9, here's your 24. And when it was 12, he said, "Well, we'll get more. We work longer." He said, "Here's your 24. Every man received likewise a denarius. And when they had received it, they murmured against the goodman of the house, saying, These last have wrought but 1 hour, and thou hast made them equal to us, which have borne the burden and the heat of the day." Now, was Jesus fair in his estimation of this? Was the landowner fair? Was the Lord of the vineyard fair? And I asked the question in class, how many think that's fair? Well, not very many think that's very fair. That doesn't seem fair to them. I mean, all the thinking they've ever done, that isn't what you call fairness. And I said, well, it doesn't look very fair, does it? No, his went this way. It sure doesn't look very fair. I said, okay, we'll go on. But he answered one of them and said, friend, I do thee no wrong. Didst thou not agree with me for a denarius, for $24 a day? Yeah. Well, take what is thine. Go thy way. I'll give unto the last as much as I'll give unto you. Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with mine own? It's my money. Is thine eye evil because I am good? Now, Jesus used this parable, and showing that Jesus was behind it. He agreed with the good man, the Lord of the vineyard. Now, I said, now, it doesn't seem fair, does it? No. Well, then you have to either see that Jesus was unfair and had wrong thinking. No wonder some people say, I disagree with Jesus. Then Jesus had wrong thinking, didn't he? Jesus was an unfair person. Now, okay, how many agreed with an unfair person? No hands went up. Well, then if Jesus was not unfair, and it surely seems unfair, then we must be mixed up. Is that right? How many agree that we were mixed up? And all of a sudden, cautious hands begin to go up, but they had to go up. You see, they were standing on the scales, Jesus on this one and they on this one. And it was pretty hard. They knew better than to say that Jesus was wrong and they were right. But they couldn't understand. Their minds were baffled. One reason you got to listen to the good shepherd, even though you don't understand him. Because your mind might be wrong. He might know more than you, might have better spiritual understanding than you. That's why God has given leaders. Because he's not a leader if everybody's going to not follow him unless they can agree. You can't possibly agree at every point. You don't know what he knows. How can you agree? Couldn't possibly agree. Couldn't possibly. Well, that doesn't seem right. I know it. You don't have the revelation yet. How could it seem right? Couldn't possibly. That's why you're called to be followers. That's some of my messages, but stay away from that. Now, but here's the point. Now let's stop back and look at it. And after I explained it, they all saw it clearly. Now here they were, men who had wives and children at home that were hungry, and they needed food, and they just lived from hand to mouth practically in those days. And they went out standing in the marketplace, meant they wanted food, they needed a job. And you notice as the day progressed, they were still standing there. Why didn't they go home? Most people today would go home. You certainly wouldn't find them at the 11th hour. They'd go home about 3 hours later and say, well, can't find a job, go home and lay on my back. See? So, but they were desperate. They said, well, we've got to stand there. We're not going to go home. We need work. We're going to stand just for chance. I may stand all day long here. But I need the money. I need food. I need bread for my children. I need milk for the babies. I can't. And for the children, I can't just stay here. I mean, just go home. Forget it. And when 5 o'clock came, Jesus comes and saw a man stand there. And you know what that tells me? That man was hungry. You don't stand there 11 hours, still 1 hour left if you're not hungry. He says, how come you're standing here? He wasn't saying, I'm boycotting. He said, no man's hired me. He's starving. His family's in bad trouble. Why hadn't they hired him? Because he was frail, or he was a cripple, or he was something. I mean, he's not getting the jobs the other ones are getting. They're coming up and choosing people, and he always seems to be the last one left. There isn't enough jobs. He stands there. Because I was looking, well, he got good muscles, and he's good and tan, he's been out, he's doing and so forth, and you, and you know, that fellow steps there, and he may be kind of crippled, but he's got a family at home. He may be thin, he may not look like a good husky worker or something. He may look a little bit bleary-eyed or something. So he stands there, so he's probably the poorest one of the bunch. Now, Jesus said, now look, you, the first one, you worked 12 hours. Now, didn't I agree to pay you a day's wages? Yes. Now, did you get the day's wages? Yes. Now, I'm not going to pay you more than day's wages. I'm not obligated to. So you're going to go home and go buy a certain amount of bread and clothes and so forth, and this will be yours. Now, you feel it's unfair that I've paid these as much as you. Yes, I sure do. I'll tell you what we'll do. Here, give me the money back. Give me the money back. Now, okay, I'll give it out in proportions, all right? You get $2 for 24. All right, now you all go home. Now, the man goes home. Oh, maybe the wages aren't that good. Maybe it's 25 cents, say, or 15 cents, or something small. They just barely made it in those days. So he went home. And all the children around the table, you can see them right now in a milking analogy, we've got a forks and spoons in the hand, sitting at the table waiting, your napkin around the neck. There they are, you walk in, and the wife runs the door, and your son says, "You get a job today?" He says, "Hey, look, I have to see you. Where's the bread at? Where's the bread?" "Well, I stood 11 hours today. Nobody hired me. All I got is just a penny video. But here, we'll divide up for the children. Well, how about Mom and Daddy? You don't have any for your plate." "Oh, we're not hungry, honey. We're not hungry. You eat it." "And nothing else, and not enough to eat. Little children are crying. Not enough to eat." "Well, see, I had to stop by. Maybe no bread. Well, I had to stop by and pay the landlord on the way home. He's going to take my house away from me if I didn't. And so I had to pay him, so there's no food for the family tonight. But here, you lay down. I'll tell you a story instead of eating dinner tonight. We'll just pray for God to help your hunger pains." And so those children cry, "I'm hungry, Daddy. I'm hungry." "Well, no, that'd be all right, honey. Here, let me tell you a little story." And you can see this pitiful sight there. Now, Jesus goes back to the first man and says, "You're happy now, aren't you? Now are you happier? Isn't that better now? Now we've been more fair, haven't we? Now we've been more fair. Here's a man who didn't have anything. And now you wouldn't have got any more money. If I paid them more, you would have had just as much bread. It wouldn't have hurt you a bit, would it? Didn't hurt you a bit if I paid them more. But now that I've taken away from them, now you feel better inside, don't you? The babies are crying. Now that's the way to do business, isn't it? Isn't that wonderful way? Let's all agree that's the best way to go." She said, "Why is your eye evil? Because mine is good. It's my money. Now, if I want to go up and I say, 'Greg, wake him up here. I'm going to give you $10, brother.' All the rest of you are going to rise up and say, 'That's not fair. You can give us $10. It's my money.' Rockefeller built a $2 million grade school in Arkansas. All the rest of the schools didn't rise up and say, 'Hey, that's unfair. He didn't build one for us.' He's not obligated to build one for them. This is why this civil rights bill they call civil rights is so wrong. It's because rights implies obligation. And if you have no obligation, then you have no, and there is not right for the government to take your property away from you and tell you how to do with it. It's your property. It's private. It's not right. It's wrong. And everybody's so violently, so confused over the issue. You're so confused. If I want to cut somebody's hair, I'm not obligated to cut everybody's hair in the world just because I want to cut somebody's hair on my back porch. It's mine. I do what I want. I mean, it's private property. As far as morals goes, it's my property, not nobody else's. And if I have an extra bedroom and I want my bedroom, I say, well, if I find a student that has a real humble attitude and is filled with the Spirit and love God, we'll take him in." That doesn't mean that some great big bearded hippie addict drunk pounds at my door, Thomas, I got to take him in because we got to be, you know, all race, religion, thinking and so forth, and bring that fella in to brainwash the house and cloud my bedroom. I don't have to do that, not from a moral standpoint. Now, the government can make any kind of immoral law they want to. But that's not right. That's wrong. That's my property. Now, if you want to take all the money that the people in the country put into a common government pool and stood up with a stick and buy a park with it, then that, of course, belongs to everybody because everybody put into it. Then it's wrong if everybody can't use it. But when it's private property, that's something entirely different. People are so confused in that way of thinking and doing things so wrong out here. Well, no wonder the Bible in the last days called wrong right and right wrong. This is unfair because you gave him something. No, it's not unfair to give somebody something. It's only unfair if people don't give you what's promised you and what you deserve. So, if I promise Marty Gamble, if he works all day, I'll give him $10. He works all day and I give him $10, I haven't been unfair. And then if Greg Gamble doesn't work even at all and I give him $10, I still haven't been unfair to him. Because it's my money. I can give $500 to somebody and $10 to him if I want to. I haven't been unfair. People understand that. You can always show grace and mercy without being unfair. You just can't cheat somebody without being unfair. And so here again, see, the spirit of the thing overrides that we operate by pure mathematical computation. But wait a minute, there's a spirit of the thing that comes underneath that, that has to readjust that mathematical computation, and you have to see it in a new light. Now let me get on to my blockbuster here. I want to get a chance to get started with it. The arguments, read Adam Clark's commentary from the book of Joshua chapter 2 on this. And the others don't have much to say. You see, what happened is the Hebrew word doesn't mean harlot anyway. It means an innkeeper. But because most women who did keep inns were taking men travelers in and so forth, if they lost their husband, all they would bounce themselves to take such a job, a public job. People came in and so forth and said, no, they generally became harlots. So it became synonymous to say harlot with an innkeeper, because one is, because she generally was. And so they say, well, she probably was because this kind of life and this kind of life and so forth. But that's not quite fair to just lump them all in that category. She may have lost her husband. She may not have been at all, it didn't necessarily imply that. It's kind of like the word Paul took heart when he came to the three taverns. Now we know he's a drinker, don't we? He's going to Rome and he took heart and came to the three taverns. See? But that word doesn't even mean tavern. We mean it's taberna, means log structure. Because but most of the log structures were inns that kept people and they drank wine, and so it became a synonymous term. See, inns doesn't mean what we call a tavern. Although they may have, well, they probably did drink a lot of wine though. They probably did. And then he didn't mean because he was going to stop there. He meant because he was getting close to Rome. But at any rate, when they came into the city, they had to stay someplace in the night. And it was kind of suspicious. They're wandering out in the streets to show that they didn't belong in the city. They had to get out of cover. Who else was going to take them in? Well, inns take you in. Inns will take you in. That's what we call them, inns, I guess. Inns will take you in. You can have eat, you can feed, you can have a bed for the night. And that's the best place to get information, too, because you're hearing all the hustle and bustle, everybody's talking. So they went into the bill, here's a couple of soldiers went to the king and said, we were out there in the inn today, and a couple of fellows we had never seen before. And we just got a good sneaking suspicion the way that they're operating and acting, various things. They are spies that have come into this city to spy out this city. And he said, well, you go pick them up. So they went out there they said to Rahab, where are these men that came out? They came to spy the city out secretly. We want to pick them up because they're from those Hebrew people across there. She had suspected this, so she went to him and told him, now, I know that they'll probably be around picking you up, I'm not sure how this narrative came exactly, because you can't tell by the scriptures, but anyway, they were knocking at the door, somebody came and told her something, and she ran and told them and hit them underneath the flax, and she went to them and said, oh, well, yeah, they came in, I know who you mean, but I didn't think and know who they were, this was just getting dark, they always closed the gates at dark, of course. They slipped out the gate, but she said, they haven't been gone very long. If you'll hurry, I'm sure you'll find them. So they sent Kintin down, and the horses went racing out the gate and off across the plain, and they were hiding under the flax. And then at nighttime, she had them slip out over the wall and sneak back to their own country. Now, she lied. She lied. Providing a lie is what we generally conceive it to be, a lie meaning an intent to deceive somebody, or that which is not the truth. If that's what a lie is, she certainly lied. Now, most commentators said that she did wrong by lying. Well, she should have trusted God and so forth and so forth. She shouldn't have told a lie and all the rest, and I don't believe it. Now, it's, well, she didn't have to say anything. Well, when you don't say anything, you've said something. You can say, oh, they heal. Oh, they heal. You have said yes. And everybody knows that they're going to look for them and they're going to find it. In fact, if they search, they will find them. Therefore, you have to say no or they're going to get found. You might just as well say yes or whatever they are. In fact, it'll go better with you if you say yes or whatever they are than if you just say like this and then they go and they find them. So that won't work. Now, in Revelation chapter 21 and verse 8, and I see I'm running out of time. I'm just getting the thing built up. Started. I'm just long-winded. That's why it's so long to the rapture, maybe. I don't know. Revelation 21:8. But the fearful and the unbelieving and the abominable and the murderers and the whoremongers and the sorcerers and the adulterers and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. So apparently God doesn't like lying. Now the question is, did Rahab do wrong what she did? Well, first of all, I want to bring your attention that what the scriptures say about Rahab. First of all, in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 31. I guess I shouldn't have taken to the mental gymnastics first. I thought I had time to do both today. I can get through this now. Hebrews 11:31. By faith, the harlot Rahab perished not with them that believed not. But when she had received the spies with peace, but when she, now here, the Holy Ghost puts her in the annals of fame and says, by faith Rahab did not perish when she received the spies with peace. She accepted them, hid them, lied about them, and so God talks about her faith. Now, what she did is, she said to them, why did she do this? She said, well, I know that Yahweh is with you. I know how you've come across and what God has done to the Amalekites, what he's done to the others, our king of Bashan and so forth. I know that your God is with you, and so I know you're going to take the city over, and I know that the city's going to perish, and I don't want to perish with the rest of them. I know your God is stronger than our gods. I know our gods can't protect us, and the other gods haven't protected Canaanites, and I know your God will. I know your God is the one that's right, therefore I am going to switch sides, and I'm now going to start working for your gods, so I won't perish with the rest of them. That's what we've done as sinners, haven't we? We've recognized, become turncoats. It's not bad to become a turncoat, providing you turn the right way. It's always good to turn from the lesser to the better. And in James 2:25, likewise also, was not Rahab the harlot justified by works? Deceit. These are the works she had. Hiding people, lying. Justified by works when she received the messengers and had sent them out another way. Now, God says she was justified. So if you say, well, I think she should have stayed and just trusted God and not done that, then you and God have different thinking. So just know that you must be mixed up. God says she's justified in hiding and deceiving those people. So all the commentators to the contrary are wrong. We don't have the spirit of the law to understand, because they're looking at the letter. The letter says, thou shalt not lie. So we got a big letter up there. But the spirit of it makes it a completely different thing when you look at it and see it in the light of Scripture. The spirit of it does not say that she did wrong. It said she was justified. In fact, in the book of Joshua in chapter 6, in verse 17 and 25, I think I won't take time to read them other than to say that the people themselves demanded of her that she not tell and she cooperate and she do these things. And if not, they would take her life. Otherwise, they would save her life, and blessed be you and blessed be thou. And she came in and married into the family of the Hebrews, and God's blessing was with them. And they were all led, including Joshua. And Joshua was God's man. And Joshua and the others were led to have her do this and praise her for doing it. Look at that in those scriptures. Now, the next step, then I go to the next step. God commanded lying, if that is lying. Let me give you some examples. God told Joshua and the others to lie or to deceive, and he intended to deceive, lying, not the truth, at Ai. He said, people say, well, I don't believe you ought to do that, brother. I believe you just trust the Lord. But I know you believe that, but it's contrary to the way the Holy Ghost leads, contrary to the way God led, contrary to the way things are being done. It's based on false premises. So God said, I'll tell you what you do. You go up to, now we've already taken Jericho. We've marched around and it all fell down flat by a power and a miracle of God. Now you go up to Ai, a little dinky town, not nearly strong. And you lay in ambush. And you people lay in wait all night long. You lay in wait, Phil. And the dew will be all, you'll be wet with dew in the morning. You lay in ambush. And in the morning, come up with a little tiny force. And start fighting them. And when they start fighting back, run from them. And they'll chase you out the gate. And you run. You run from them like you're fearful. Really, you're not. So you're lying. And when you get them drawn up, others will be hiding out here. And those when ambush will come out. And we'll deceive them. We'll lie to them and make them think we only have a few people. And we're scared. We'll deceive them. And we'll go in and we'll take the city. That's what God told them to do. And they did that. So God commanded them to lie to those people. Or to deceive them. If lying is deceiving. Now, he also So Moses said, send spies out to the land. You know what spies are? They're deceivers. Deceive them. Make them think you're one of them. Now, why didn't they at Ai say, well, brother, we'll just get the army up, trust in Yahweh, go out and trust God to give us the victory? Shouldn't they have done that? If you think that's the better, how many think they should have done that? Trusted God and gone out without an army. But if you do, then you're saying that the Holy Spirit made a mistake because God told them to go a different way, do it differently. So unless you're smarter than God, then we're confused. If that's your thinking. Now Moses sent spies out. Why send spies out? God said they could have the land. He told Abraham. God said, go up and deceive them and look over the land. You say, well, yeah, but the people demand the lack of faith and they ask for spies. And so God said, okay, that's true. But God does not go out and do wrong principle because some people complain. You can accuse God of, well, forcing God to lie because some people complain. So God will go out and he's like a man. You can force him to break his principles and do wrong. No, God doesn't. You can't force God to break principles and do wrong. God said you go out and send spies. So apparently God wasn't worried about deceiving them. Now also he deceived them with Gideon. You put your lamps and your pitchers, and we only have about 300 men now. So you cut down from about 33,000 down to about 300 men, and you go out with 300 men, each one with a pitcher and a lamp and a trumpet. And then you break it, and you give it to the temple of the Midianites, and blow the trumpet, and you shout. Now what they'll do, this is deceit, because each contingent, each battalion of troops had one man with a lantern. You know, all the soldiers are not going to carry lanterns. You know, I mean, they can't fight with lanterns. One man carries the lantern to lead the way. And the bugler, as we would say. One man to give the command on the trumpet, as the captain tells him what to do. But when they heard 300 trumpets and saw 300 lamps, they thought there were 300 battalions out there. There was only 300 men. And it threw them in confusion, and they fled the camp. And they were many times more than the others, but they didn't know that. God said to them, God set up the strategy. God said you lied to them, deceive them. Now let me go to Ohio. Let me go to Nishtep. It gets worse. God lied, if lying is deceiving. God said, now, you go up there, I'm going to send a sound of chariots in the trees, the mulberry trees, the tops of the trees. And the Syrians out there, they heard chariots coming by the thousands. And God sent his breath through the winds of the trees, and you could hear the wheels of the chariot moving. And God began to send this, and made a sound of chariots in the trees, and the Syrians fled. Deceit. By God's Spirit himself. But, he said, wait a minute, brother. You're going to accuse God of lying? God says in Titus 1 and 2, God cannot lie. That's what it says. And I believe it. I believe everything he says. Somehow your theology is going to have to include everything he says. And you're going to have the Spirit underneath it, too. So that means one of two things. If God cannot lie, but God deceived, it means either that God cannot lie to his own. When he makes a promise to his people and promises them, he will not lie to them. But it does not include the fact that he will go out and lie to the heathen. He hasn't promised them anything. He doesn't owe them anything. It either means that, or it means that deceit and somebody, an intent to deceive them and to tell not the truth is not a lie, providing that is the spirit of the letter that spirit overrides the letter. It means it's not lying if it's for the best of mankind. Now, Jesus lied, if that is what a lie is. Because the scripture says when he came to the house of Peter in Capernaum, Jesus decided to try to deceive Peter. He made as though he would go further, the Bible said. He had to come and just turn right into Peter's house. That's what he wanted to do for the night. So, rather than come right into his house, he made as though he would go further and started to go on. And he said, oh, wait a minute, come and stay in my house tonight. Well, all right. Thank you. He already knew he was. He intended to, but he made as though he would go. Now, why did he do that? Jesus did that, according to the Bible. Somehow, we're going to have to face up with what's... It's here a little and there a little. Too many people collecting data and getting dogmatic without seeing the whole picture. Now, I haven't yet got... I'm leaving you like a dangling participle out there. I haven't got... In fact, it's going to get worse before it gets better. If you think these are hard things, I got harder ones right over the horizon here to get there. Much harder than these. Now, don't go out and tell people yet that this pastor believes in lying. Just hold on. We'll catch it next time. Be sure to be here.